From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the haunting melodies and harmonies of the McGarrigle sisters. We have a concert and interview with singer-songwriters Kate and Anna McGarrigle. The concert will include an old song written by Anna, made famous by Linda Ronstadt, and a new song the McGarrigles haven't yet recorded. The McGarrigles' first two albums, recorded in the mid-70s, have just been reissued on CD. Also today, how do you explain to a three-year-old why he has no father? Writer Anne Lamott tells us how she does it. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Bosnian President Alija Izetbegovic told the European Community's foreign ministers today he'll consider joining new peace talks aimed at ending the civil war in Bosnia. From London, NPR's Michael Goldfarb reports.
Izetbegovic met the foreign ministers at the community's semi-annual summit meeting in Copenhagen. The Bosnian president had flown there in the hope of persuading the EC to prevent the breakup of Bosnia, as envisioned by the latest proposals put forth by the Bosnian Serbs and Croats. But the EC has resigned itself to the fact that it doesn't have the power to make policy on the ground in Bosnia. The Serbs and Croats will meet in Geneva on Wednesday to discuss with the UN and EC representatives their plan for splitting Bosnia into three republics along ethnic lines. Izetbegovic said he would return to the Bosnian capital Sarajevo to consult with his colleagues in the collective Bosnian presidency. He's likely to come under pressure from fellow Muslims to accept reality and negotiate with the Serbs and Croats. I'm Michael Goldfarb in London.
Advocates for Haitian refugees expressed dismay today over the Supreme Court's decision that allows the federal government to return refugees to Haiti without an asylum hearing. The court's ruling reverses a lower court that said immigration officials were required to consider individual claims for asylum before the refugees could be sent home. In May of last year, President Bush ordered the Coast Guard to forcibly return all Haitians headed for the United States without hearings on their individual claims. Haitian activists called the decision a giant step backward for refugee law. The United States would no longer block loans to Vietnam from the International Monetary Fund if President Clinton accepts the recommendation of key foreign policy aides, NPR's Ted Clark reports.
The Departments of State, Defense, and Treasury have urged the president to allow renewed IMF lending to Vietnam. Mr. Clinton is expected to reach a decision on the matter before an IMF executive meeting next month. Vietnam badly needs the loans to improve roads and communications and to cure its ailing economy. If Mr. Clinton agrees that IMF lending should resume, some veterans and some families of Americans missing in the Vietnam War will accuse him of easing economic pressure on Hanoi before the missing are fully accounted for. On the other hand, if IMF lending resumes, American businesses will want the president to go further and lift the U.S. economic embargo against Vietnam so they can win contracts for projects financed by the IMF. This is Ted Clark in Washington.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 16 points to close at 3,511. The NASDAQ Composite Index was down 0.86 at 688.73. Advancing issues led declines by a slight margin in heavy trading. This is NPR News. President Bush told the Republican National Committee today that he will not accept a $12,500 a month stipend from the party, and he'll return $50,000 that's already been paid to him. GOP Chairman Haley Barbour defended the payments today, saying they've been paid to former President Reagan since he left office in 1989 and were extended to former President Bush this year. The stipend comes to $150,000 a year, slightly more than the former president's public pension of $148,000. The existence of the payments was first disclosed in Business Week. The crew aboard the space shuttle Endeavour is getting down to work today following a one-day weather delay before liftoff. Dave Pignanelli of member station WMFE reports.
Endeavour found blue sky amid a few scattered clouds this morning that never posed a threat to the liftoff. The shuttle will now conduct a series of maneuvers over the next several days intended to move Endeavour closer to the European science satellite Eureka. On Thursday, Commander Ron Graby will move the shuttle's robot arm into position to grab Eureka. It will then be tucked inside the payload bay for its return to Earth. Meantime, the crew has activated the SpaceHab module located in the front of the payload bay. The module is a series of lockers, each containing experiments for its customers. The commercial venture has produced few clients, though, and on this flight, all but one of the lockers have been leased back to NASA. The highlight of the mission is scheduled for Friday, when two crew members conduct a four-hour spacewalk. For National Public Radio, I'm Dave Pignanelli at the Kennedy Space Center in Florida.
A self-styled rebel leader is claiming to control the government of the former Soviet Republic of Azerbaijan. The leader, Surat Guseynov, said he's taking over to fill a power vacuum left by the sudden departure of President Abulfaz Elchebey last week. Elchebey has taken refuge in the southern part of the country, but he's told reporters that he has not resigned. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Today we have a concert and interview with Kate and Anna McGarrigle. Critic John Rockwell once described their music as delicate and subtle, so vulnerable and private that you sometimes want to turn your head away. He said it's the natural honesty in both their music and image that allows the sentiment in their love songs to ring so true. Both Kate and Anna write songs, sing, and play piano, guitar, and accordion. The McGarrigles grew up in Quebec. They record infrequently, which is just one reason why their fans will be very happy to hear that their first two albums from the mid-70s have just been reissued on CD by Ryko Disc. The McGarrigles first became known through songs recorded by Linda Ronstadt and Maria Muldaur. The song the McGarrigles are about to perform was the first song Anna wrote and became the title track on a popular Linda Ronstadt album.
Heart Like a Wheel.
It's a beautiful song and beautifully sung. Thank you both for doing it, Kate and Anna McGarrigle. Now, the song that you just did, Heart Like a Wheel, I think, Anna, that was the first song that you wrote?
Yeah.
It doesn't seem possible to me, you know, to start off with something that good.
Well, it's sort of an awkward little song, but anyway,
why are you calling it awkward?
Well, because it sort of moves. It changes metaphors in the first verse, you know, and it's just, I think it was just kind of written off the top of my head, and I didn't think about what I was doing.
Why did you decide to write a song?
I don't know. It just felt like it.
1969, everybody was writing songs.
Yeah, I think it was that.
Instead of poems, everybody was writing songs.
Yeah, I think it was something like that.
And that's one of the songs that helped establish you commercially, I think, because Linda Ronstadt recorded it. How soon after you wrote it?
I think she recorded it in 1973,
maybe?
70? No, either 74, 75. I'm not absolutely sure.
How did she hear it?
Well, Kate had sung it.
We're not sure if she heard it, actually. We never asked her. We should, actually. I used to sing with... When Anna first wrote the song, I was working with another girl called Roma Baron, and we were kind of hanging around the village in New York, and we had taken the song, we worked it up, and we would always finish our set with it. And someone got interested, someone in a group called McKendry Spring, which was around New York at the time, and I think they had the same either agent or manager that Linda Ronstadt had. But at another time in that same year, because we had only worked together for a year, we opened for Jerry Jeff Walker at the Gaslight in New York, and he said, oh, what a lovely song. Could you give me a tape of that? I'll be working with Linda Ronstadt, and I think she should hear it. And we gave him a tape. So I'm not sure which one, but I suppose either one of those two.
There's another singer that helped establish your reputations, you know, as songwriters, and that's Maria Muldaur,
that's
who recorded
right.
some of your songs.
Yes.
And one of those songs was one of your songs, Kate, Mendocino.
No, she didn't.
She
do
didn't
that.
Record Mendocino?
No,
the work song was
Linda
the
Ronstadt song. Recorded Mendocino oh, later on, but the work song.
Play a few bars of that, the work song.
Mm-hmm.
Right before my blues were blue, when the good old songs were new, songs that may no longer. The darkies about Jesus.
That one.
So, what was it like for you to have other people doing your songs? This was before you had started recording your songs.
Right. It was great. It was truly terrific to have something that you've written come out. I remember Maria Muldaur did this song on the Johnny Carson show, and she said, I'd like to thank my friend Kate McGarrigle for writing something like that. And I was just
thrilled.
Thrilled.
So how did you start performing your own songs after other people started doing them?
Well, and the second, on Maria's second record, there was a song she, at this point, what she did or what her producers did, they said, well, the first record worked so well, let's get some more songs from the same writers. So there was David Nickturn and myself and a bunch of other people. And so I gave her a tape, and she learned this song called Cool River, and they flew me out. And I wasn't sure what song they were doing. They said, come out and play the piano. And I got to the studio, and they were in the session with about six, you know, heavy-duty musicians, and they said, play the piano, please. And I said, I don't know the song. And they said, well, I thought you wrote it. You gave us the tape. I said, no, that's my sister Anna. And they didn't really know about Anna. And they said, well, where is she? I said, in Montreal. And they actually said, do you think she'd come out here if we called her up? And I called you, right?
I was only too happy to take an airplane. I think I brought my accordion out with me.
And so she came out, and at that point, we had already changed the arrangement. But since we were both there, we sang backup on her version. And that came out on her second record, Waitress in a Donut Shop. And then Greg Prestipino, who was working, helping her get songs, said, can I bring the girls into the studio since they're both out here? And that all happened in a week. And literally, we went in, put down maybe six or seven songs that we had written, not really knowing each other's songs that much, but, you know, Anna would have the lyric sheets to my song. She would sing harmony. I'd sing harmony to her songs. That's why we all ended up singing our own songs at the piano.
So until the Maria Muldaur backup vocals, you weren't really performing together?
No.
We only started performing together when Warner Brothers asked us to sign a contract. And then we realized we had to get some kind of act together.
Which was about a month after we did that demo tape.
Mm-hmm. And we did, you know, we did a couple of little folk festivals, and then we actually got a band together when we finished our first record. Neither one of us had ever worked in the context of a band with a drummer.
But I have to say, Anne and I did work together as teenagers in a group that we were folk singers, like the Weavers.
Uh-huh.
But we were like the backup, you know, there was a tenor, a bass, and the right. two of us. And we'd get to sing one song in the set, and we had three songs that I think we rotated for 10 years.
Kate and Anna McGarrigle are my guests. More of our concert after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guests are Kate and Anna McGarrigle, and their first two records have just been reissued on compact disc by Ryko Disc. Let me skip ahead a little bit, and let's hear a more recent song than the song we opened with. And Kate, this is one of your songs. It's called I Eat Dinner. Do you want to say anything about writing it, Kate, before we hear it?
Everybody thinks the song's about me, but it's actually about Frida Kahlo. I know Anna says she'll like,
the painter? Yeah. The painter?
Yeah, there's an excerpt in the biography of her by Hayden Herrera, saying where she's between husbands and lovers, or somebody's left her, or at this point two people have left her, and she writes a letter to a friend saying, for the first time in my life, I'm having dinner by myself at the kitchen table without any candles on it. I mean, it was the vision, because this woman had her life full. And
so Kate said, let me see now. I haven't got anybody in my life right now. I have a very pokey little kitchen with a little round table. And I just happened to have a daughter. So, but it was, I think, Kate says it's not really about her, but I think it is.
I don't eat leftovers.
That's true.
Why don't we hear the song?
Never thought that I'd end up this way.
When the hunger's gone.
Kate and Anna McGarrigle. What a wonderful song. And I guess maybe, Kate, it's a little bit about you and a little bit about Frida Kahlo.
Well, yes, I suppose so.
I want to get back to where we were before, that you hadn't started performing together till after you recorded backup vocals for Maria Muldaur. I imagine as kids you sang and performed, or at least in the house together?
Yeah, we actually, our father thought it very important that we know how to sing and play. I don't know why, but our parents played at parties for people. I mean, like, they weren't professional musicians, but my mother had a very lovely singing voice, and he would always accompany her, and they'd sing, party songs, kind of. And he was very, very musical. Our father was very musical. And he would teach us songs, and which we thought were dreadfully boring at the time, but he'd actually say, I'll give you a nickel if you learn this song, or something like that. He found it very important to teach us what he knew, the songs that he knew.
What kind of songs did you think of as boring that he taught you?
The stuff that he liked really was stuff that was So my father was born in 1899. Our father was born in 1899. So he was in the first war. So in a way, there was a whole period in there of kind of sentimental ballads of people going away, and a lot of them not coming back. I mean, my mother remembering her mother crying because her brother was killed at Passchendaele, and that kind of. And there were many songs that we heard later, like on old John McCormick records and stuff, but mostly American songs that had to do with people going away, I guess because of that war. That was the first kind of war, which included Stephen Foster songs and that kind of stuff.
Do you think that's responsible at all for the melancholy strain in so many of your songs?
Absolutely. We were explaining last night, we sang a song, I should say in the context of the tour that we're on, a song called Gentle Annie by Stephen Foster, and I sort of said this was the first song I remember my father playing or hearing, and of course he taught it to us, and Kate sort of jokingly said other people had songs, sort of happy sort of children songs, and I said we always had songs about death. But I mean, we were an incredibly happy family. Nobody is really sad in our family. I think we're all sort of fairly well adjusted.
There's a new song that you have that's very much in the kind of folk ballad tradition. It even uses a lot of phrases from traditional ballads. I think this would be a good time to ask you to sing it. Which of you wrote it?
I wrote it. Anna wrote it. And I call it Appalachian Dream, and it's about growing up in the Laurentians and dreaming about Appalachia.
No, the Laurentians part of Appalachia?
Well, they're actually not. They're separate.
Are?
No, I thought Appalachia was the ones on the other side of the St. Lawrence River.
But, the St. Lawrence River is a fault, and if that weren't a fault, they'd be
I guess. I always thought of it as Laurentia, so I don't know.
It's because you're Canadian.
And when did you write this?
In the last month and a half.
And let's hear it. This is a song by Anna McGarrigle. Anna is on guitar and vocals, and Kate is on vocals and banjo.
Yes, I must also want to say that it's kind of all a tribute to some people who were in our lives, not who we didn't really know necessarily or know well, but like there's Pete Seeger, who's kind of like the Bells of Rimney, and Johnny Carignan, who was a fiddler who plays the Hangman's Reel, and various people like that that we knew as when we were teenagers, that loomed very large in our lives with the songs they sang and the music they played.
Let's hear it. This is Appalachian Dream. By and by.
grew up by and by. Frail my heart apart and play me little shady grove. Ring the bells of Rimney till they ring inside my head forever. Bounce the bow, rock the gallows for the hangman's reel. And wake the devil from his dream.
Kate and Anna McGarrigle performing in our studio. That's Appalachian Dream, a song written by Anna. There's so many folk songs that are alluded to in that. Did you go through a period when you were starting to perform of doing traditional folk ballads?
Well, when we started singing, we kind of... we sang all the time at home, and when we were 10 or 11, we'd try and learn some Everly Brothers songs and stuff like that. And then... But the age of 13 or 14, I think we heard Joan Baez or something like that. And we started hearing some folk music. Then we met these people very quickly. I think I was about 15 and I was, 16. And these guys were already in their mid-20s, almost 30. And they just had access to incredible stuff. They'd say, why do you want to do a song the song that Joan Baez says? Go to the source where she got it. And so they had us at the Record Center taking stuff from the Library of Congress and collections of stuff by Sam Charters and stuff done, just real field recordings. And they just put us right back into the original places.
Kate and Anna McGarrigle. The McGarrigle sisters' first two albums, Kate and Anna McGarrigle and Dancer with Bruised Knees, have just been reissued by Ryko Disc. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. The McGarrigle sisters will be back with us in the second part of our show.
My daddy came to see me. He came dressed in black. He said, Katie dear, yeah, I know I want you back. Oh no, oh no, oh no. Yeah, no, I want you back again. You know I can't stand to leave.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, more of our concert with Kate and Anna McGarrigle. They'll perform one of their French songs from the mid-70s and a song from their latest album. And writer Anne Lamott explains to her son why he doesn't have a father. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. In an 8-1 ruling, the U.S. Supreme Court has let stand a presidential order that allows the U.S. Coast Guard to forcibly return Haitian refugees to their homeland. NPR's Nina Totenberg has more on the story.
In May of 1992, President Bush, facing an onslaught of tens of thousands of Haitian refugees fleeing dictatorship and poverty, signed an executive order directing the Coast Guard to intercept all Haitian refugees on the high seas and to forcibly return them to their homeland. Presidential candidate Bill Clinton harshly criticized the order and promised to revoke it if elected. But President Clinton did not change the order. Lawyers representing the Haitian refugees went to court, claiming that federal law forbids the return of political refugees fleeing persecution and that no refugee could be returned without a hearing first to determine whether he was entitled to political asylum. Dissenting, Justice Harry Blackmun compared the forcible repatriation of Haitians to the treatment of Jews fleeing Hitler's Germany prior to World War II. I'm Nina Totenberg at the Supreme Court.
In a series of radio interviews today, President Clinton has said that he believes the Senate will approve a deficit-cutting budget plan this week. Mr. Clinton said he thinks that there will be approval for his plan because no alternatives have been given. Mr. Clinton refused to predict what kind of energy tax Congress will pass, but says his bill includes new spending to create jobs. Appearing on 6 radio talk shows to try and gain public support for his economic plan, Mr. Clinton called his ideas the only real plan on the table. So far, the biggest difference between the House and Senate measures is that the House proposal calls for a broad energy tax, and the Senate measure calls for a 4.3-cent a gallon increase on gasoline and other fuels. General Motors and the United Auto Workers Union say an increase in production of the Chevrolet Cavalier will result in the callback of nearly 1,000 GM workers. Don Gagne reports.
Currently, GM builds Cavaliers in Lordstown, Ohio, and at a plant in Mexico. Today, the company said, starting with the 1995 model year, the compact cars will be built at a plant in Lansing, Michigan as well. The local union has agreed to a new contract, which the company says gives it the flexibility it needs to produce the cars at a competitive price. Workers say they gave no pay or benefits concessions. Sam Stott is currently a part-time worker at the plant.
I know that the opportunities are tough out there, you know, and this is a great opportunity for me to possibly get a job that I can retire from. It's been tough around here the last few years.
Despite today's announcement, GM says its plans to close some 24 other plants around the country are still on track. For National Public Radio, this is Don Gagne in Lansing, Michigan.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up more than 16 points to close at 3,510.82 in very heavy trading. This is NPR News. In the wake of the latest breakdown of a peace plan in Bosnia, leaders of the European community are trying to convince the nation's Muslim president to accept a plan to divide the country into three ethnic regions. EC officials say that government officials in Bosnia want a sign of goodwill that talks in Geneva will not simply continue while Serbian and Croatian forces roll back Muslim forces even further. So far, there is no guarantee of how any international group can preserve a Bosnian state divided into three zones, as Western nations continue to stay away from any military involvement in the fighting. In South Africa, at least 13 people have been killed in separate attacks in Natal. This latest round of violence comes just days before high-level meetings involving leaders of the African National Congress and Inkatha Freedom Party are slated. Virgil Keane of the BBC reports.
The killings in Port Shepstone came shortly before the announcement of the meeting between the two leaders. Although there's no direct link, the murders underline the difficulty facing anybody attempting to bring peace to Natal. The meeting between Mr. Mandela and Chief Buthelezi may have some calming effect on their supporters, but it shouldn't be forgotten that past appeals from the two men for peace have gone unheeded. And while there may well be handshakes and smiles on Wednesday, the very real enmity and hostility between the ANC and Inkatha is unlikely to die away. The overriding issue is whether an atmosphere of stability can be created at a time when the battle for territory is escalating ahead of the election, which is set to take place in the next 12 months.
Virgo Keane reporting from Johannesburg. Astronauts in the space shuttle Endeavour are settling down to work after morning liftoff. Yesterday's morning launch attempt was delayed for a day because of bad weather. Launch this morning was 22 seconds late because a small airplane strayed into restricted airspace near Cape Canaveral. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with the second part of our concert with Kate and Anna McGarrigle. The McGarrigle sisters have been recording since the mid-70s. Their first two albums, Kate and Anna McGarrigle and Dancer with Bruised Knees, have just been reissued. You know, in talking about some of the influences on your music, you grew up, I think, in French-speaking part of Montreal?
Yeah. Well, we grew up in the Laurentians, about 40 miles north of there, and we went to French schools in a town called Saint-Sauveur-des-Monts.
Well, you've written some French songs. I should ask you to do one now.
Okay.
There's a song called, pardon my pronunciation.
Go for it.
Complaint Saint Catherine.
Pour Saint Catherine, yeah. Complaint for Saint Catherine.
Anna, you wrote that song?
I wrote it with a friend. I wrote the music and our friend Philippe Tatarchev wrote the lyrics.
Before you perform an excerpt of that song for us, tell us what it's about for those of us who don't really understand French.
Okay. It's a song that reflects the ambitions or the lack of ambition of the common man who just wants to sit back, not get involved in politics, watch television, his hockey game on Saturday night and his beer, very important. He won't spend money to go and, get a motel in the Laurentians. He'd rather, just stay in his little flat. And that's basically it. I mean, it was written quickly and for fun.
And which instruments are each of you going to play for this?
Okay, Kate will be playing the accordion and singing, and I'll be playing the piano. Okay.
And singing.
Right, and singing.
Moi, je me promène sous Sainte-Catherine. Je profite de la chaleur du métro. Je me regarde pas dans les vitrines quand il fait 30 en dessous de zéro. Y a longtemps qu'on fait de la politique, fait dans la guerre contre les moustiques. Je ne me sens pas intrépide quand il fait frais, je fais pas du ski. J'ai pas de motel à Laurentide, le samedi c'est le soir du hockey. Y'a longtemps qu'on fait la politique, fait la guerre pour les moustiques. Croyez pas qu'on n'est pas chrétien, le dimanche on promène son chien.
It's Kate and Anna McGarrigle performing in our studios. And I should mention that the first two McGarrigle Sisters records have recently been reissued by Ryko Disc. I saw you years ago, back in the late 70s, in Quebec, and you performed a concert there. You spoke mostly in French. You did a lot of French songs. Are you political about French in the way that a lot of people in Montreal have become very political about not allowing English?
boy, you can get into hot water by saying anything, I'll tell you that.
Right.
I think we're traveling right now with two francophones in our band. And there's something, there's a humor that they have that's just, that doesn't really, we're having just the best time. In some ways, I kind of find, but I mean, there is always English moving in on anything, whether it be a Spanish community or Italian community, anything at all. It's always, it's there, you know. Mm-hmm. And to lose that would really hurt, but in some ways it does create a kind of a, creates a little tension, unfortunately.
My guests are Kate and Anna McGarrigle. They'll perform another song after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Kate and Anna McGarrigle. Some of your songs seem pretty personal. And Kate, let me ask you this. You were married to Loudon Wainwright for a while.
That's right. Yeah.
And he's the father of your daughter.
And my son.
And your son. Mm-hmm. And he writes very personal songs too. And some of those songs seem to be about you.
The earlier, nastier ones. To be honest.
Right. How do you feel about that?
Ah, I just got asked this recently. Well, you know, I kind of have trouble sometimes separating Loudon the person from Loudon the songwriter.
Uh-huh.
I mean, he's a brilliant songwriter, especially when he's writing nasty songs about people. I mean, that's really where he's at his best. So he's really turned out some very good, nasty songs about me. And sometimes I think I just had to pull way back, you know. I guess. But now I see that he kind of writes songs about my kids. And, I don't know. I mean, I think Loudon just likes or has to write songs about people who are, you know, who are around him.
Did you ever try to write a nasty song about him?
I don't have that kind of heart. No, wit.
Yeah, I think Kate makes herself more sort of like the victim rather than she doesn't go after the person so much. So it's kind of sweeter what comes out.
Now Rufus, our son, is writing songs about both of us.
But who is?
My son Rufus. He's 19.
Oh, and he's really?
Right. Yeah, so just there you go.
Final tradition of songwriters.
How do you work out the harmonies when you're working up a song?
I guess it depends on the song. I was going to say, less and less, we seem to concentrate less and less on harmonies now, let's say when we're in the studio, because of our last thing with Heartbeats Accelerating, where we had a producer who really, he wanted to get a certain sound, and I don't think he wanted big block harmonies. That wasn't what he was into. But we've done all that stuff before, like on Kitty Come Home on our second record. You know,
we just
layered and layered stuff.
And 18 tracks.
And I guess in those days, I think, no, we were trying to get a desired effect. It was kind of, it was odd sounding. To me, it sounded like something like some kind of ghastly little creatures sort of flying around at some point, you know, like because of some of the harmonies. But there's a definite way where the way we don't want to have them sound, and I can't, when they're just too blocky
right.
sounding. When you have, what note is it on the bottom that we don't want normally?
The third. You don't want the third on the bottom. I think also it's nicer to have wider spaces between them as opposed to when everything's just very closed up together. Well, also depending whether you're singing from your high range or your low range, and what you sing on stage is not what you put on record. What you put on record, you really, because you have more control in a studio, you can have effects going where you just cut words off and they put more echo on it and they, you know, they can change it more. But on stage, you have to really just kind of be straight ahead and be musical that way.
It's been a few years, two, 3 years since your last record?
About two and a half.
Came out in 1990.
Would you want to be putting out records more frequently than that? Or, I mean, is that by choice or by... not, Joyce.
That was a very difficult record. Well, no, we could have had one earlier. I mean, after we made that record, Pierre Marchand, our producer, really extracted so much out of us in some ways that we were just exhausted because he wanted every idea that we had, but we never got to play them. We only got to, what he would do is we'd record, we'd play the song in the studio for the fun of it. Then he'd record everything. Then he'd take little ideas that we had, put them up in a computer and onto a keyboard and sample them. And then he'd reconstruct the song using all those ideas. Then after he had that done, we would have to go back and play it exactly where he had put our ideas. So the whole thing was like building, it was like building a house. At no point did you ever really sit down and play. So Anne and I were just so drained.
It was so different from the way we're used to working. Where we're running the show and we weren't doing it that so much. But I could also understand why he was doing it that way. He was trying to make us sound different from the way we had sounded before.
Would you like to sound that way again? Did you like that kind of architectural approach? An almost auteur approach to doing it, where somebody works it all out and then you have to... Mm-hmm.
Yeah, some of the
songs
were good.
But they worked it out with our ideas. That was the odd thing. Like, they weren't very much his ideas. He was looking for the stuff that we had, little riffs here and there, you know.
Uh-huh.
And some of it's nice, but not, it's exhausting, and it's not very rewarding, like when you're in the, it's not rewarding when you never kind of get a buzz of, you know, God, that was a great take, or boy, everybody played well, you know, you just never have that.
So you live about 90 minutes away from each other. Is it good to have that distance so that you're not with each other all the time?
I don't think it would make any difference. I mean, I think we probably, you know, when Anna comes to town, it's a great joy for me. We, instead of rehearsing, we go shopping.
Yeah, the thing is, it's funny. I think as you get older and you have families of your own, that you just don't have time sometimes for your old friends. And I miss that, you know, but I also know that Kate's my best friend and I hope I'm her best friend.
You're my only friend.
Yeah, right. Kate's so mean and nasty.
I'm awful. All those things Loudon said about me were right.
But we're very, very, very close.
And I have great bread stores on my street. Within one block, I have four they make beautiful French bread. So when Anna comes to town, she lives in this kind of
all I can get is sliced bread.
So because Anna lives in the country, so she can only get city food. But you know, when you live in the city, you get beautiful stuff.
Country food.
Let me ask you to close with another song. And this is a song from your most recent album, from
Heartbeats.
Yeah,
Accelerating.
Heartbeats Accelerating. And the song is Love Is. Before you perform it for us, this is a song that was written by both of you and
our sister,
your other
Jane.
Sister Jane. Mm-hmm. How did you collaborate on it?
Anna and Janie wrote this. I actually wrote one line.
She wrote the best line.
And wasn't it generous of them to give you credit?
Very generous. I thank them very much. I really do.
Anna, anything about how the song is written?
No, one day I went to Jane's house. I said, let's write a song. I started writing it. And then when she got off the telephone, she continued.
She's our manager.
A chord change. And then she went back and I just continued. So it was a collaboration.
And who's playing what on this?
Kate is playing the nylon string guitar. And
singing backup.
That's right, singing backup. And I'm playing the piano and singing.
Lead.
Front up.
Okay. Well, before we hear Love Is, let me thank you both a lot for doing the concert. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very, very much.
My guests have been Kate and Anna McGarrigle, and their first two recordings have just been reissued by Ryko Disc, and here they are to perform one last song for us.
A steel guitar. Love is a battle scar. Love is the morning star. Love is a 12-bar blues. Love is your blue suede shoes. Love is a heart. And is still a band of gold.
Kate and Anna McGarrigle performing in our studio. This is Fresh Air. The Supreme Court has ruled on the U.S. policy of intercepting Haitians on the high seas. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Linda, what will you have on All Things Considered?
Nina Totenberg, Terry. Who else? Nina Totenberg will be reporting to us on the decision that the Supreme Court has made that this is a policy they can live with. We also have a story on Mexico losing some General Motors jobs back to Detroit. The administration is selling the budget here in Washington. We'll have a story on the partitioning of Bosnia and a commentary from Dan Shore on the same subject, and the first in a series of conversations on the progress of Middle East peace talks. Also, Leslie Nielsen today.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Novelist Anne Lamott has written a new memoir about how miraculous and maddening it is to be a new mother. Her book is called Operating Instructions, A Journal of My Son's First Year. We enjoyed her book and her Fresh Air interview and wanted to hear more about her life as a mother. Her son Sam is 3.5 years old now, so we invited Lamott to write a piece that would help bring her journal up to date.
Sam, at 3.5, does without L's and a dad. The L's are not such a problem. I usually know what he means, although yesterday he told me fiercely, after undressing himself, I don't yike my heels, and it took me a minute to realize that he meant the heels of his feet. Why, I asked, and he answered, because my socks get stuck on them. L's will come in time, and until then I know that yeeves are leaves and yunch is lunch. It's almost certainly something that will change, whereas he may not ever have a dad. It's a great source of concern to him. He wants one, he imagines he has one, and he wants to go find the one I've told him a little bit about. His obsession is most frequently triggered by seeing happy children with their dads, either out in public or on TV. Is that the little girl's daddy, he'll ask? I think so, I'll say. Is he a good daddy? I don't know, honey, I say, although I want to say, nah, I bet he's a rotten, passive-aggressive narcissist. You're better off with just me. Does she yike her daddy? Nah, I want to say, mark my words. 15-20 years and this whole relationship is going to end up in lawsuits and ugly recriminations. Yes, I think she likes him, I do say. I like my daddy, Sam says hopefully. Honey, I say, you don't have a daddy. Why? Because your daddy went away. I'll go find him, Sam says. I don't even know where he is, I say, which is the truth, which has been the truth almost since I found out I was pregnant. Sam's daddy and I had a deal. I was going to go ahead with the pregnancy, and he was going to have nothing to do with either of us ever. Which was okay with me, but which is not okay with Sam. It grieves him. For a while, when the other kids' dads picked them up at daycare, Sam would solemnly tell these fathers, I don't have a daddy. One day, his daycare giver sent me a note which said I ought to consider therapy for him. I went up to her house, loaded for bear, and saw myself smashing around the head like a baby seal. Instead, I said through gritted teeth that I thought he was handling it just great, perfectly, in fact, because he was telling the truth and feeling his feelings. Then I took Sam home. I was crying. It's okay to cry, he said, parroting me. I nodded and said, yes, it was. It's okay to be afraid, he said, and I said, yes, it was. My daddy got too scared and went away, he said. My mouth dropped open. Boy, you got that one right, I wanted to say. But what I did say was, honey, everyone doesn't have something. You don't have a daddy. I don't have a daddy anymore, and I wish I did too. But look, we don't have a swimming pool either, and we're getting by. Then I added hopefully, but we have each other. And he looked at me with a very adult expression as if he were about to stick his finger down his throat. You make me laugh, I said, smiling, shaking my head, setting him down on his feet. You make me yaff, too, he said, laughing out loud. And then we just walked on home.
Writer Anne Lamott, her new memoir is a journal of her son's first year. It's called Operating Instructions. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our concert with Kate and Anna McGarrigle was engineered by Ron Barron with assistance from Audrey Voblaitis. Joyce Lieberman is our technical director. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. We're closing with music from the McGarrigles' most recent album, Heartbeats Accelerating.
Love, love, where can you be? Are you out there looking for me? Love, love, where can you be? Love, I am waiting. Heartbeats accelerating. Will you come when all is still? From the river off the hill. Love, love, where can you be? Love, I am waiting. Heartbeats accelerating.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the George Gund Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The next Fresh Air, the aftermath of the war in Afghanistan. We'll talk with Barnett Rubin, an expert on Central Asia and a professor at Columbia University. We'll also discuss his recent trip to three Muslim republics formerly part of the Soviet Union. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.